Well, welcome C200 members to our Game Changers Council call with Betty Murray. I want to thank our Houston co-chair, Margarita Farmer, and of course, my council sisters for opening the call to our C200 membership. The response has really been overwhelming. You may have attended Betty's session at our annual conference in Dallas. As you know, Betty is a certified nutritionist and a certified functional medicine practitioner, as well as CEO of Living Well Dallas. Her diagnoses are science-based and science-backed, which we all appreciate. She has recently been on the national networks speaking on the topic she's covering in depth today. As a matter of fact, I was recently in DFW Airport and I saw Betty on the TV monitor speaking on NBC Nightly News about what she's going to talk with us today. And then I landed 2 hours later in Nashville. And there she was again on the TV monitor speaking on another network at the same time. So I know her office has been swamped with calls, so I very much appreciate your time. She talks about what's true, what's false, and what's currently available to personalize your diet and lifestyle for your genetics. Betty will speak and then we'll go into a brief question and answer session. So we want to make this as interactive as possible. This is the July 4th holiday weekend, so we want to be very casual about this, but we want to come out as informed as possible. So with that, Betty, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. So thank you. And I recognize some lovely faces from the event last fall. And thank you so much for having me. So what I wanted to cover today is I want to make sure that we all are aware of what your DNA is and what does that mean, and what the current research shows. And actually, I'm going to talk about a recent study that was published in the last little bit that has a second leg that's in process right now. And then kind of opened up to conversation, because when I spoke at your C200 event, I was talking a lot about women's brains, women's hormones, and then also the kind of risk for cognitive decline in women, Alzheimer's, and sort of where genetics plays a role in that. But, you know, genetics is a much broader conversation, and there's a lot of information out there, and then there's a lot of, I think, misinformation or overstatement. And actually, I was telling Kathleen earlier when I did that spot for the news network, they came to my office to interview. They interviewed me for about 30 minutes. And I think probably everybody at C200 has probably had this happen more times than I have. But I said, please make sure you say one of these three statements. And I gave them three very short, perfect bullet points, you know, and basically the gist of it is the biggest things you can learn about your genes is your genes load the gun, your lifestyle pulls the trigger. And so the message that needs to get across is it's good to have that information. It's very valuable, but the real value is in where you can determine what's going on with the diet, lifestyle, and all the other pieces, because that's where the action occurs. And when it finally got edited, that was kind of shortchanged a little bit, because the soundbite was more fun to say, hey, you get your genetics, we can find out everything there is to know about you, about how you can just lose weight by taking a genetics test. And so, it was good, but you know, there's always a little more to the story. So the first off is I just want to do a kind of quick genetics primer, just a very easy sort of conversation about it so we understand what that means. So would we have genes, right? So our genes, we get one copy from mom and one copy from dad, right? And they got their two copies from their mom and their dad. Some genes only exist on the X chromosome. So some women actually have some chromosomal advantages over men because we have an X chromosome, and there are certain genes, I'm going to talk about those in a minute, that may only exist on the X chromosome. So X means women, Y means men. And when we like to talk about sex-linked traits, but when we're talking about genetics, and we actually did, hold on, my light just turned off. There we go. When we talk about genetics, up until about 25 years ago, in the medical community, there was this thought that we have all these genes. We'd have a bunch of genes that were these kind of on-off switches. And that it was a real straightforward sort of thing, that all of a sudden, you'd have the brown-eyed gene, the blue-eyed gene, the blonde hair, and that we could manipulate those genes quite easily. When we finally got to the Human Genome Project, where we were able to start sequencing those and start pulling apart those little sequences of amino acids that make up the genes, there was also this idea, too, prior that we had these junk genes, that there were some important ones in there, but there's a bunch of junk genes that didn't do anything. Which, if you look at anything in nature, there's nothing in nature that's junk. There's always a purpose and a meaning for everything, even though we may not understand it. So when they did the Human Genome Project and they started laying out these genes, what they found is when you look at the big parts of what makes a human, all of us are quite similar, about 94% similar. So there's very little variability in female to female, male to male, ethnic background to ethnic background, that humans are humans, right? And actually, when you look at us compared to a chimpanzee, we share almost all the same DNA. Where the variability comes in and where we really play and where most of the research is going is in the genes that don't determine your hair color, your eye color, your height, that kind of thing. There are a bunch of genes in your body that encode to change something, right? So they either make an enzyme or they process a pathway, so they make something, or they make a protein. And that those genes determine how we process things in our body, and they are very nutritionally and lifestyle and what we call epigenetic driven, right? So our genes are those single nucleotide strands that make up who we are, and then your epigenetics are what we think, breathe, eat, create, come in contact with, what our body creates is really where the meat of decision-making process happens, and it's where we have the most power, right? So when we do the Human Genome Project, we are able to map out the genes, and today there's two ways to test for genes in humans. I've had both done in many, many labs. I know there's other people that have probably had more genetics tests done than I have, but I've tested different labs to make sure that they came back with the same data. So you have what they call full genome sequencing, which means that they've read every single gene in your genome. The most common company that does that is a company named Illumina. And Illumina, years ago, it was offered for about $5,000. Now it's about $1,500, and it depends. Sometimes, I think in another year or two, it'll probably be down in a couple hundred dollars. And what that does is that gives you every single gene, right? So they can see every single thing. The more common test that we see and the more useful test in a lot of ways because it's more affordable and more accessible to people is a thing called a SNP test. And a SNP test stands for single nucleotide polypeptide. So a SNP is a mutation, right? So we're looking at different parts, just little pieces of the gene sequence that encode for different things that we know about. So your Ancestry.com, your 23andMe, your companies like Habit, or all of those companies are doing single nucleotide testing, right? So SNP testing. And much of the research is in that arena because it is more affordable and faster to do. When they first did the Human Genome Project, it would take a month to run a genome sequence on a single person. Now it's down to a couple days and a couple hours. It used to be, when I got mine done, I think it took like 21 days to run a sequence, right? So that's what made it so expensive. So it's become more reasonable, but SNP testing is fairly fast. And for instance, if you wanted to get your genome mutations tested, your SNPs, then the cheapest and probably most accessible is the commercial company 23andMe. I don't have anything to do with them. I have no financial interest in them. They just happen to be doing direct-to-consumer genetic testing. And the reason is that the more people they get to do genetic testing, the more we're able to start unwinding this information and get more data. So let me go back. So that's how we test for it. So I have a copy from mom and I have a copy from dad. So think of those as like X's and O's. So I have an X or an O. Right? Now, mom could have gotten two X's from her mom and her dad, and dad could have gotten two X's from her mom or her dad, or his dad, sorry, his dad. Well, it could be her too. So either way, so we got, maybe we have two X's on each side. In that case, we have what they call homozygous copies. They are identical. If I have an X and an O from one parent, then that is heterozygous, X and O. If I'm the child of that parent and they both have X's on each side, I will absolutely have an X, right? There's no chance I can have anything else. But if mom has an X and an O and dad has two X's, I have a 1 in 4 chance to get the O, right? Because you kind of match that up. So when we looked at the genetics, what we found is that we have combinations of X's and O's, to simplify it, in different sequences on the gene that code for different things. And there's a population of people that will have X's or O's based on their environmental inputs. So when we started looking at different groups and different people, we started recognizing that there's numbers of people that will have more common genetic combinations. So let's say an X and an O is more common, right? So that just all that means is there's more people in the population that have that set of genes on that particular sequence on the gene that codes for whatever it is. And then the person that might have an X and an X may have the less common, or what they call wild type. So in the genetic language, what you will find are those two statements. You'll see mutation and wild type. So the ones that are more common are wild type. The ones that are mutated are the ones that are less common. So that's the first kind of miscommunication. When we're talking about gene mutations, the ones that we can manipulate through diet and lifestyle, we are talking about genes that are mutated, right? That the action that's supposed to happen at that intersection or that gene may be altered in some way and may not work as well as it could, right? Mm-hmm. When we're talking about a genetic defect, right? And a genetic defect can be things like cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy. That is where there is an actual missing gene or a defect or a malfunction within the strand itself. And those are very specific. And those are very, there's not many of those. And most of the time, we already know that those are present because you have family members in the family history and the family tree that have it. And those can be tested, like when someone are pregnant. A mutation is different than a defect. So when we found the genes and we started looking at them, what we started looking for is we were trying to figure out, for instance, what genes increase our risk for Alzheimer's, right? Because we see that there is families that have more risk for that, or families that have more risk for cardiovascular disease. And what they were really hoping for was this single light switch that you could turn on or off and say, oh, if these people have Alzheimer's, they have the Alzheimer's disease state switch turned on, so therefore they're going to have it. And so the first thing that we found was the diseases that we look for and that we generally die from in the West are complex diseases that don't have a single switch, right? Yeah. So that's a real important thing to know because, you know, and I talked about the Alzheimer's gene and I'll bring it up here, but a lot of times it's like, oh my gosh, I have this dreaded gene. What am I going to do? Well, the truth is none of these genes work in isolation. There may be one that has a lot of research that shows it may weigh heavily, right? It may be graded heavier, but always more than one that is playing, right? So when we look at our genes, we have the wild type, which is the most populous. More people have that combination than the ones that are mutated, right? So where we saw the mutations and the variability in the population started to play out in where these groups actually hailed from, so where their ancestors came from. So I'm going to give an example of a gene that many of you probably heard about. If you haven't, you probably will. It's a gene called M as in mother, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, F as in Frank, R as in Ralph. M-T-H-F-R. Sounds like I'm swearing at you. So that gene has been studied for about 25 years. It's got thousands of papers out there on it. And that gene, very simply, creates an action that changes B9, which is one of your B vitamins, it's called folate, into its most active form. And what it technically does is puts a methyl group on it. And you're like, okay, talking science jargon, what does that mean? So think of it this way, I have a new way of explaining it. So I have B9. When you get B9 in your diet, you get it from dark green leafy stuff. And when you get it in your diet, that dark green color that you get is usable, but only somewhat usable. So once you get it in your diet, it goes from dark green. We have a gene that changes it into Kelly green. We have another gene that changes it into light green. And then the MTHFR gene changes it to a very pale lime green. Once it becomes that lime green color, it then acts with B12 that does the same thing. And what they do is they come over to another gene called MAT and they make a thing called SAMI. And this is the important part. So SAMI is the tape that goes on your light switch of your DNA that tells your DNA to stay on or off. So my grandmother lived in a really old house in Nebraska, and she had one of those old school heaters in the bathroom that was really dangerous. And so instead of having it removed, she would put a piece of tape, like masking tape, over the light switch and say, don't turn it on, right? So it's kind of the same thing. Your genes are a bunch of light switches, and they work in combinations with each other. And most of your genes are either off or on all the time, right? So we're born with like our perfect expression of our genes, and some of them are on and some of them are off. The tape that goes on your light switch that keeps that gene for, let's say, cancer or cardiovascular disease or whatever, has a tape on it, and that tape is created by that stuff called SAMI. It's technically S-adenosylmethionine. I'm not going to test you. So what became really important was when they started looking at this particular gene, and it's become an example for all these other ones, they found that 51% of Caucasians, for example, didn't have mutations in this gene, and they were very good at it, right? 49% do. And there's a couple different versions of this gene. And so of that 49%, another 50% of those had really poorly acting enzymes at that gene. So they weren't great at making that lime green folate version. So all of a sudden, the thing that's supposed to make the stuff to control your DNA isn't working very well, right? Well, so they found that in Caucasians. They found that in people from Africa and African descent, and people from South America, Mexico, so your Hispanic and Mexican cultures, and they found it in Japan, but they didn't find so much of it in Indochina. They didn't find so much in New Zealand and other areas, right? Unless they were like the indigenous people from New Zealand and Australia. So what was very interesting is this genetic change happened based on where that population's ancestry came from. So the other really important thing to know about your genes, whether you have the wild one, which is more populous, or the mutation, is those genes are not necessarily all bad. Those genes are the way they are because they were selected for through natural selection, through millions of years of what our ancestors went through. And at some time in our history, that gene did something good for us, right? Or for your people from where you're from, because it conferred some sort of advantage in that environment. Okay. So that particular gene, using it as an example, 49% of most populations have a mutation in it. And what has changed is not that gene. What has changed is the environment that gene has to deal with, which is what we eat, what we drink, what we think, the toxins we come involved with, the foods, all of that stuff is altering the capacity of that gene to work because it's not getting what it needs, or what it has to end up doing past it is being overwhelmed. So when we look at our genes, we have those mutations that at some point probably conferred advantage in particular groups that don't. So MTHFR became a really good gene for us to study, because what we found, again, that it showed increased risk for Alzheimer's, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and autoimmune diseases. And so when we did the Human Genome Projects and started looking at these variations, what we really also found was, hey, if these people don't make that lime green version of folate really well, what if we give them the one they don't make, right? So the studies started looking at, can we add more of that ingredient that's supposed to be made by that gene and override its incapacity to do it well? Right. And that's really the intersection of genetics and what they call nutrigenomics, which is using the diet, lifestyle, and all these other things to hopefully manipulate those genes to alter their expression. And so you say, okay, so I've got genes. I get copies from mom. I get copies from dad. I have some that are really common in the population, and then I have some that are mutated that may or may not work. Where does that play out? So once we found MTHFR, probably one of the most other talked about gene is the Alzheimer's gene. Have you guys all kind of heard of the Alzheimer's gene?
Yes.
And many of you heard my talk, and some of you may have had it tested. So the Alzheimer's gene that is most indicative, but not a guarantee. So again, it loads the gun, but doesn't pull the trigger, is a gene called APOE, A-P-O-E. And that gene, if you look at where it came about in human existence, is literally the change on that gene came about when we moved from something that looked more like a chimpanzee in the trees to where we actually started walking on the ground and becoming a more sophisticated hunter. So Dr. Dale Bredesen, who has done a lot of research and studies at the Buck Institute on Alzheimer's, calls it technically what he called the God gene. And the reason is that gene altered out of the chimpanzee population, because when we climbed out of the trees and started walking around and fighting and chasing down animals and hunting, and then especially hunting and cohabitating together, two things happened. We had a greater risk of injury, right? It's either injury from fighting for our food or fighting with animals to try and eat them. And we also had a greater risk from infection, either from injury or stepping on something or eating something that might have been bad compared to when we were up in the trees. So what the APOE gene does is it changes our inflammatory response, and it actually made us have a faster inflammatory response. So inflammation is good when it's short-lived and important. So like if I fall and break my leg, I want to have very short-term inflammation, because that's going to tell the body, send red blood cells there, send white blood cells there, make sure I clot, make sure I don't get an infection. But you want that inflammation to be only when needed and stop. Same thing when you have a cold or a flu. You have an inflammatory response that's trying to get rid of that virus or bacteria, and then it slowly calms down. It's in the turning on and turning off capacity that's important. So when that APOE gene mutated, what it mutated from was a version. So we have three versions of that gene. The most common version is one called a 3, right? So if I have a 3 from mom and a 3 from dad, I don't have any greater risk for Alzheimer's than anybody else in the population. When we climbed out of the trees, it converted to a version 4. The number is really just our naming convention, but we altered basically a protein on that gene, and it altered how it worked. And it made us more capable of doing a short-term inflammation response, so we could keep from getting diseased and ill from those things, injury and infection. Well, that was great, right? When we weren't living in crowded environments and we didn't have, you know, a lot of injury, right? Because there weren't that many people on the planet. Fast forward, you know, a couple million years, and then all of a sudden now we're living in high density population environments. We have an environment that has changed a lot, and that inflammatory response is getting triggered by our lifestyle, right? So if I have a 4, let's say I've got a 4 from mom and a 4 from dad, means I'm very, very well charged to get inflamed, which is great if I'm in an environment where I'm going to get, you know, come across really bad, nasty infections. Not great if all I do is sit on LBJ. Anybody that's been in Dallas knows LBJ is terrible. or any kind of horrible traffic, and that I have to talk on a cell phone, have a conference call, and I only get 3 hours of sleep a night, right? That inflammatory capacity isn't awesome when my lifestyle may be inflammatory. So that APOE4 gene is the one that has the greatest risk for Alzheimer's, and it carries a greater risk for diabetes and cardiovascular disease, because it encodes for that short-term inflammation that we should have because our environment isn't so toxic. Right? So if I have a 4-4, what the research shows, if I have a 4-4, what that research really shows is that I have a 7-fold increased risk of Alzheimer's over my lifetime compared to a 3-3. And mostly in older life, right? So we also look at it and go, well, Alzheimer's is such a big problem now. And when our generations collectively end up at that threshold, it'll be a bigger problem because there's so many more of us. We're living longer. So we're getting to the capacity where these things are getting expressed, because in 1900, our average lifespan was 57 years. So I don't want to go back through my C200 conversation, but we have a lifespan that has expanded rapidly. So we've almost doubled our life expectancy compared to what it was 120 years ago, but our genes haven't changed, right? But our environment and how toxic it is has. So when we look at genes, that MTHFR gene and that Alzheimer's gene gives us a picture of where we're able to see where we might carry risk, but it may or may not turn on, okay? So I'll use myself as an example. I've been sequenced many, many times. I've had my genes done. And to tell you, I spent thousands of dollars getting my genome sequenced, and I got my SNPs test, and they match. So don't worry about getting a really expensive one. The cheaper ones are pretty accurate now, unless you're looking for this kind of red herring sort of weird thing in your family that they can't find. And what I found when they first started looking at all of my genes, so we have those two genes that we know a lot about, but if our environment's the real problem, we start looking at the uniqueness of Pam or the uniqueness of Sandra or the uniqueness of Liz, what we find is within all of these genes, there's these massive combinations. So if we really look at Alzheimer's, for example, as a disease, there's about 17 genes that are really strongly correlated, right? If you have mutations on those genes. So it's the combination of all those genes together that starts to amplify or decrease risk. So it's not so simple as a single light switch to go, oh, I've got the Alzheimer's gene, yes or no, right? So one of the things that we do when we're looking at them is you want to take a, it's kind of like, are you a strategic person and a CEO and you're up here at 30,000 foot and you're looking at the broader scope of what's our strategy, or are you tactical down in the weeds and making things happen at a very, you know, in a very more detailed way? Our genes work as strategy. Our lifestyle works as tactical. Right? And what we do with our foods and all those things, because it's the combination of genes that make the difference, not just one. So even if you have the dreaded APOE gene. So when I first did my genetics, I did it very early on with 23andMe, and I'd already done three other labs. And so 23andMe at that time, they have some limitations from the FDA because the FDA did not like them reporting all that information directly to consumers. But at the time, they took what they knew from the data. And of course, the data is constantly changing because we have more and more people getting their genes tested. But what they did is they took those combinations that we knew and kind of laid them out in an order and said, of your genes that you had, here's your greatest risks, right? Based on what your map is. And so, you know, I look at it and it, you know, my top five in reverse order, one was colitis. Well, I do what I do now because I was diagnosed with colitis. This is my really third distinctly different career. I originally went to school for a business degree and was in business sales and marketing. I got caught up in the early 90s in technology and have a million certifications for everything from database administration to code writing, which I was never good at. And I managed IT for 11 years for a company here in Dallas. And while I worked for them, I already had problems digestively, but I was kind of ignoring them as a college student and a young adult. But while I was working for them, I was diagnosed with colitis, and which is an autoimmune condition. It's digestive. It's unpleasant. And one of my first questions was, can I do something with my diet that may influence my digestive disease? And the doctor looked at me and kind of laughed in my face and said, absolutely not. There's nothing to do with diet with this disease. I was like, a five-year-old could tell you that it's got to have something to do with food, because if I don't eat, it kind of stops, right? So that kind of led me down this journey. So I've been back in school off and on for 15, actually closer to 18 years now on this whole nutrition journey. And I ended up opening Living Well 14 years ago after I went back and started my private practice. But it really was my own personal journey. So when I saw that colitis come up, I'm like, huh, that makes sense. You know, and knock on wood, I've had two flares over 14 years, right? And both times I was like, okay, I know something. I kind of know what happened with that. And I've been symptom-free for a long time, and I don't take meds. I'm lucky, right? And I'm also very cautious, and I do a lot of things to take care of my body. The second one was celiac disease. Well, one of the things that was a major trigger for my symptoms of colitis was gluten and wheat-containing grains. So I had gone gluten-free. I, at that time, was uninsurable. So I'm like, fine, I don't need to go check any more of that. So I've been gluten-free. The top two were Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, number one. Right? I'm adopted. I have no family history to look back on. I have no idea what it looks like. Right? So I can't look back and go, Aunt Sue had this or Grandpa had this. So I look at it and I'm like, okay, I really don't want Parkinson's because that's neurological and results in roughly a very terrible experience. And same thing with Alzheimer's because I do carry the APOE gene. I've got a 4 copy. I don't have a 3. There's a newer version of that called a 2. That's like less than 11% of the entire population even have a 2. And the one copy I have is 4%. They don't even study it. But it was my other combinations of genes that went together with it that mapped out to increase the risk. So when we look at these genes, the other things that they do is they help our cells do enzymatic activities like burn fuel, right? So they help us metabolize glucose. They help us metabolize fats. They help us utilize proteins. They help us make and get rid of hormones. And many of these things help our cells inside detoxify. Now that word gets thrown out a lot, and I almost want to use the word biotransform, but 75% of every nutrient you take in goes to the cleanup process in your body that we call detoxification or biotransformation. So your body makes a bunch of energy, just like your car, there's a bunch of exhaust that needs to get cleaned up, and that's how your body takes care of itself. It's got to be able to clean that up. Well, the inability to clean up that exhaust is where you see mutations in cells and things like cancer or things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. That detox process needs to keep going or you start to cause injury to a cell, then a tissue, then an organ, right? So when we looked at these maps and we started laying these out, we started seeing, wow, you know, Pam and Betty are both Caucasian, but Pam's need for particular nutrients is quite different than Betty's because of her combination of genes means that she may need more B12 or more folate or more vitamin C or magnesium because whatever was going on with her ancestors over these millions of years, they had different nutrient needs for their environment, right? And so what we're able to now do is start looking at not only how you're wired, but then how can we possibly influence that wiring in your lifestyle and diet to mitigate or kind of override what doesn't really work well? And so that's where the research is really going. So there's a new study that came out called PREDICT. You know, so we've mapped out the genome, and at first it was the Hail Mary. It was like, oh my gosh, we just map people's genome. I can tell Liz she needs to eat a high protein diet. I can tell Julie she can do a ketogenic diet. And then I can tell Pam, you can just eat as much carbs as you want as long as you're low fat. That's what we were hoping for. It's not that simple. But we do know that there's some variability. So when we did the Genome Project and the PREDICT Project started, what they did in PREDICT is they took 700 identical twins, right? And then they took 100 Americans of various backgrounds. But 700 identical twins, that means their DNA matches 100%, right? So they have the exact same combination. And what they found was that the DNA strictly probably had about the influence of about 40 to 45% of what was happening. But within those twins, they found significant variability in other stuff. So for instance, let's say I had Bob and Ken, they're identical twins, their DNA was the same. When Bob ate, let's say, potato chips, Bob had this massive, crazy glucose spike. So his blood sugar went really high. The other twin ate potato chips, nothing happened, or very little, like not what you would expect. They weren't identical. Right? And they kept doing it again and again. And so what they found is that the genes make up about probably 40% of what our body's gonna do, and our epigenetics lays over top of it. And what was really neat about this PREDICT study, it's huge, is they looked not only at the variability, like let's look at what happens with glucose after they eat, but they also looked at what our microbiome was doing. So our bugs in our gut, our bacteria and our yeast and things like that. And then they're still, they probably have enough data right now because they're using machine learning and they're capturing a bunch. They probably have enough data to keep 40 PhDs busy for about 5 years because they captured so much content. But what Predict was able to do, and they're starting Predict 2, is start to show that we have a layering effect. So you have your genetics as kind of how you're wired, right? So I was always going to be 5'3". You know, there's no way I was ever going to be taller. That's what my genes predicted. I was going to have brown eyes. But I have, on top of that, my microbiome. So your bugs in your gut, which is the next thing we sequenced. So once we could sequence human genetics, we started sequencing our gut microbiome genetics. So we have about 22,000 different genes in our gut. We have trillions of genes in our gut that are our bacteria. We have about 4 to 7 pounds of bacteria in our gut. They control your immune system. They control your mood. They control everything, right? So we need those guys. It sounds really disgusting and we don't like them, but our bugs in our gut are good. And the more variety we have, the better. But those lay on top and they influence metabolism. So they influence what things come in and out of the bloodstream, what things get absorbed, what nutrients get made, because some of them are made in the body. And then we have on top of that what we call your epigenetics. So like I was alluding to, how we eat makes a difference. So whether it's organic, whether we eat a lot of vegetables or not, whether we eat processed foods, whether we live in an urban environment, right? So if I live in a city and I'm, you know, constantly on the street of New York, my pollution exposure is way different than the Carolinas, you know, where Kathleen is, right? So that's your epigenetics. And those are the two areas that we have a high probability of being able to manipulate. So when I look at it and I go, okay, let's say we'll use that MTHFR gene as an example. If I'm somebody that has a poor working MTHFR, so that enzyme doesn't work, I don't process folate very well, and I eat truckloads of green vegetables. Let's say I am just a green vegetable. Let's say I'm a really good vegetarian. I eat lots of it. I might be able to override that gene not working because I'm taking in so much of it that I just give so much raw material that it doesn't matter. Now, if I'm somebody that has a poorly working gene and I eat the standard American diet where ketchup and iceberg lettuce are the two most common vegetables, I'm going to have a major problem because I already am not eating anything that remotely looks like what's needed. And I could also be somebody that has the wild type good gene that works perfectly, and I could eat that diet and mimic what's bad about somebody who may have the gene that's mutated. Right, so you can have what my friend Ben Lynch calls dirty genes that aren't dirty. You're eating dirty that makes them dirty. So what we eat makes a difference. So when we look at it from a standpoint of trying to pull apart the function of your body, my love is to have your genetics on one side so I know kind of how you're wired. And what we look at over top of that is the exhaust that comes out of the body. So the really cool thing is we can look at the chemical reactions that happen. So when you're like, when your cell, like your cell, your muscle cell burns glucose, it produces a bunch of byproducts. So think of it as exhaust coming out of a car. And when it burns fat, it has a bunch of exhaust coming out of it. And it tells us how much or how good we are at burning fats or carbs. And the action that happens at those particular endpoints are controlled by those genes. So we basically can take the genetics and map out on top of it the exhaust fumes coming out of the body, either through blood, urine, or saliva, and look at what's really happening. So we can really tell not only what you're wired for, but what's really being affected, what you're expressing, right? And we can also look at what the bugs are doing in your gut and how they're influencing it, which is really the next frontier, because we're starting to see when we look at this stuff, our bugs, our bacteria eat vitamins, they use stuff just like we do, and they make exhaust too. So sometimes the question now is, are we seeing just the artifacts of our own metabolism or theirs too? And it's a combination. So really the next frontier probably in medicine is figuring out what are the bacteria, virus, and other things doing in the body and how they're influencing us. But when we look at it from a function standpoint, we now have the technology to not only look at your genes, but look at all those other pieces so we can individualize what we're trying to do down to a vitamin type and version down to a dietary type inversion. Now, again, it's not a perfect match. I can't look at your genes and go, you're keto, that's it, right? Because there's a lot of other influences that may be playing into it, but we can see where the body leans, and then we can track and change based on what your second layer of function is, right? So it makes it much more individualized, because we are getting to the point where you can do personalized. I do nutrition, obviously I don't diagnose or treat, but we can do individualized nutrition, and we can start doing individualized medications and individualized medicine. When we look at our Western medicine model, which rocks in a lot of ways, right? If I get hit by a car, I want to go to a hospital where they have standard protocols. When they see a bone sticking out of the leg, they know exactly what they need to do. But if I come in and I have a problem with my digestion, I may have a diagnosis that looks like colitis, but the reason why I have colitis may be very different from somebody else that has something that looks like colitis. The problem is our diseases that we die from in the U.S., like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, are multifaceted, and a one-size-fits-all response generally doesn't fit. And even in traditional oncology, and I know many of you might be able to speak to this, even in oncology, we're starting to do genetics on the tumor itself to see what behavior the tumor will respond with, to see what its possible endpoint may be if it does move to somewhere else or metastasize. We can look at a genetics on a tumor and say, hey, this medication may work better, even though it may not be made for that particular disease state, because this tumor is expressing this certain behavior. That expression is the same thing that we look at when we're looking at that, what we call your nutrigenomics. So this idea of personalization is spreading across medicine. Where it's beautiful is when you can spend time and really work with somebody, because it's not something you can do in 5 minutes. I can't look at your genetics and all that other stuff and in 5 minutes write you a prescription and have it fixed. But when you're able to really pull apart those pieces and individualize things, it gives you not only what to do, but it gives you something to monitor. One of the things I think is very frustrating for people when they're trying to work through possibly chronic diseases or those kind of things, is a lot of times we have this sort of watch and see or watch and wait mentality. And so the person that's watching and waiting is really watching and worrying, right? Because it's like, we'll just wait until we see it again and then we'll attack it again. I'd like to know what my potential is for this thing to reoccur or for this issue to come up, because maybe I might be able to do some things in front of it to keep it from happening. So the more we're able to personalize and the more we're able to capture in your unique genetics and your unique expression, the more we're able to monitor, which is where I really enjoy what I do, because I can dig it apart and look and go, okay, the research. So I always go back, you can ask Kathleen, I hand out so much. I'm like, do you like research? Hold on a minute, here's a bunch of studies. It's probably one of the biggest reasons why I went back to get my PhD, was beyond contributing to the studies. Like we're involved in two IRB rounds right now. We've got two studies starting, and I haven't even started my dissertation. So we're doing studies here because I want to be able to contribute to the research out there. But the other thing is I also wanted access to it, because an abstract doesn't really help. You want to really know what happens. But I do. I dig through it. And if I find something that doesn't look normal, I start digging for the research. And I look not only at what I found, but what is also contrary potentially that's out there to what I think. You know, so there is a lot of data out there, but it's not easily implemented in a traditional environment where speed is of the essence. And I think that's the big challenge. If I had my dream and if I could change medicine, I'd want to make what we do at our clinic universal as your primary care environment, where somebody really is playing the quarterback and digging through what you do. So you can have that level of individualization, because I think the end point where we're dealing with long-term chronic disease and disease management, which is what most of the Western world is looking at, that we might be able to keep it from happening in the beginning and keep people well instead of just waiting for them to slowly fall apart.
We have about 15 minutes left on the call, and I thought maybe we could open it up to questions. How does everybody feel about that? Does anybody have any questions for Betty at this point?
I know I threw a lot out.
You did.
As much as I could.
So Betty, what exactly do you recommend then if we don't have any of these conditions, mm-hmm. that like irritable bowel syndrome or anything like that, But are you recommending that individuals do the testing for the MTHFR and APOE and those other things in general now?
You know, what I would say is I'm a person that believes knowledge is power. You know, I'm a data person. I like data. I don't want to be drowned by the data. So that's important. So if you have a curiosity about your own health and what things you might be able to do to improve it, or also if you have children or grandchildren and those kind of things, if you want to, because you pass down your genes, so the more of your family that know it, the more you can kind of pull it apart. I'd say it might be of interest to you to get your genetics tested. I don't know if I would do just those individual ones. If I really wanted to know my overall information, I would probably use a company like 23andMe, because you can get your entire genome SNP tested. They test for about 500 different mutations for $200, right? Whereas if you go and submit that on LabCorp, let's say, to your insurance, they will probably charge you $200 to $300 for both of those. You know, and some people worry about their privacy on something like 23andMe. You know, all they do is they take, you order the kit, you pay for it with a credit card, you use your email address. So if you don't want it associated with you, create a Gmail that you get rid of. And when you get the kit, you turn it into a number. So they turn you into a number. So they depersonalize it and you spit in this tube. So they get your DNA and then you become that number. You could use an email you never use again. You don't necessarily, you're not required to use your own name and your own birthday. It's your data, right? So, you know, and you can choose to participate as a larger part of the research community, or you could say, don't use my data in research. But they will come back and tell you if you have like the APO gene, that stuff is in there and they are allowed to report on it. For a period of time, they couldn't. And they do report on some other things. Most of what they report on are what I call the cutesy parts of nutrition. Like, are you a bitter taster? Are you, are you more likely to crave sugar? There are some genetics for that, but I don't find those valuable. What I want to know is all of those other intricacies. If somebody has that test, we have software that digs through the data from it and maps it out to where it's usable, right? The stuff that's kind of underneath the cute reports that 23andMe puts out. And then we use other testing like traditional lab testing and things to sort of get that other information. I personally think it's valuable.
That actually was my question, Betty, because I did 23andMe and I have all the raw data, but I'm not a scientist and I can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
I looked through my data and of course I have the APOE on my chromosome 19, which apparently is not good for Alzheimer's. In later stage. I mean, I'm just reading this as you're talking. I know, I'm like, what the? I'm trying to understand with all the data that I have, what can I do to get a better understanding?
Yeah, so what we look at, so for instance, like the APOE gene, so that one encodes for inflammation. So if somebody's a carrier of 4, they want to be really careful about their insulin and glucose levels, diabetes, those kind of things, because they're at greater risk for that. So your food quality needs to be better. Stay away from saturated fats, sugars, that kind of thing. So what we do is we take that, and then there's a test called a NutriVal or organic acids. And for lack of a better term, I'm a car person. I love cars, right? So if I had my favorite like dream car and I want to know my engine's running, I'm going to take it to the car shop, the dealer, and they're going to hook it up to the exhaust. And when they look at the chemical coming out of the exhaust, they'll tell you, oh, the fuel pump works or whatever, the fuel injectors. When we look at those intersections of those genes, what we're looking at is byproducts in the urine, right? And those byproducts in urine, we test for those when somebody's born. So when a baby's born, we test their urine to see if there's any mutations in the capacity for this stuff to work. Because if they do have it, it can cause birth defects and things like that. And some of them are very severe. But we never check it again. But that's where this data lives. So we can look at all of those exhaust things and look at what's happening. So for instance, if somebody has that APOE4 and they're worried about their ability to metabolize, let's say, sugar, right? Because there's a risk for that, increased risk. We can look at what happens in the cell, in the powerhouse in the mitochondria, which is where it gets burned, the actual action, and tell you whether it's efficient or not long before your glucose gets high or your blood sugar gets high. So we can pull that apart, and that's a urine test that we do. You know, so what I do with my clients is the first thing we do is take a huge history, right? Because I want to know everything about you. And the more I know, the more I can ask questions. From that, if you have your 23andMe, we run it through our professional software so we can, and it reports, prints a report that's valuable, right? That can tell you kind of what's going on. And then we do that test, and we might do other tests. We might do hormones. We might do advanced, like, cholesterol screening. We do a lot of unique stuff to look at everything we could possibly dig apart, or like stool testing. No one likes to do that, but it's a very good test. We do all those different tests depending on what you need to look at to figure out how we need to personalize. So we take the genetics in the report and we layer that stuff on top, and we start telling you what to do to make that better, right? So yeah, because there's so much data. And the thing is like, I had my genome sequenced at 23andMe probably 5-6 years ago. And the reporting that they're giving now compared to what they did 5 years ago is dramatically different, because they have millions of more people doing it, right? So the more people that do it, the more we're able to determine it, right? So, so there's always new information coming out, but you can take that and use some data out of it. You know, and if somebody's really nervous about getting their genome sequenced, like I don't want to know if I have the Alzheimer's gene. There are people that I'll say, you know, if this is something that would make you nervous and worrisome and kind of really, really bother you, it's not necessarily worth it to know it. If it's empowering, it's worth it to know it.
Right.
And I just happen to be one of those people that I like to know, because I'd rather know now so I can do something, so it's not when I'm 65 and I'm starting to show signs that I start to figure out I have a problem. Because these diabetes, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, any kind of cognitive decline are 20 and 30 year processes that we could intervene at any given time. That often once they get extremely pronounced, it's so much harder to act on them, right? It's much more powerful if we can prevent rather than treat. You know.
So I had a question. Oh, sorry. I had a question too. I'm kind of in the second phase that you talked about. So I was able to do my DNA, and some of the recommendations were more vitamin in nature. So take like CoQ and vitamin A, vitamin D, and creatine. So I've been at that protocol for about a year. I feel roughly the same. Is there a way to know, is it working? I mean, I'm fine to do preventative because it's a good thing to do, but I just didn't know, is there another way to check that exhaust? Most of my tests are okay.
Yeah, yeah. Because a lot of times when you go to the doctor and you get your kind of checkup, they're looking for pathology, right? So usually things don't show on those basic reports unless it's disease causing, right? So a lot of the times that looks normal and you're like, I don't feel normal. So when I have somebody that I've done their genetics and I've looked at their nutritional pathways over top of it, I always have them take everything out. No supplements. I'm like, I don't take medications out, but we leave supplements out. Then if we supplement, like if there's reason to put in creatine or vitamin D, we later on go back and retest it. Cause what we should see is those markers normalize, because even if you have the gene, you may not need the creatine, right? It might be valuable for you, but you may not need it, because you might be eating in a way that you don't need it or exercising in a way that you don't need it. And that's where I think it's good, because your genes, again, just load the gun. If you don't pull that trigger, you don't pull that trigger. So, for example, autoimmune conditions are a really good example of this. 50 million Americans are assumed to have autoimmune condition. It eclipses, diabetes and scope, but we look at them all individually, so we kind of ignore it. In 1900... there is very little in the medical literature about anything that remotely looked like autoimmune conditions. So 100 to 150 years ago, these were virtually unheard of. So then the next argument becomes, oh, well, we're not living long enough back then to have it. Well, the population that get autoimmune conditions are people under the age of 40 on average. So they were alive. They had the genetics for it, and they didn't have it. It's our environments, the 87,000 chemicals that we have since the industrial age, it's all that. So just because you have them, you don't necessarily need them, but you can always go back and test for them.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure.
So I have a question. This is Julie.
Hi, Julie.
So how many of practitioners like you are there out there? So, you know, I've had my, I've done 23andMe. I don't really have any big health risks, but there have been a couple that I've been reluctant to turn on until I've talked to my primary doctor. But so if you turn something on or you have an issue, How do we find someone like you to help us?
Yeah. So most of my secondary training, obviously I've got, even in traditional schools, I happen to be getting my PhD out of the only one in the country that teaches what they call systems biology. Which is this paradigm. So the paradigm is functional medicine, and it encompasses nutrition. Nutrition is probably a bigger aspect of it than traditional medicine, but it is designed and made for physicians. Where it's different is it says, okay, when you look at our Western medicine, it was born out of warfare and illness, like infections, right? Which we do a great job with, but we die from diseases of complexity. So functional medicine at its core says we need to get higher up. We need to take a strategic 30,000 foot view and see where these things interact, right? Because again, if you have diabetes, your risk for cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's triple at least, right? So they're not individual. Those systems all coexist and they overlay. So when you look at functional medicine, that's kind of the umbrella. Now, there's a lot of different, I also say it's kind of like Brahms, right? There's a lot of different flavors of functional medicine, depending on where those practitioners came from. Like if it's a gynecologist, they're probably going to lean more towards women's health and hormones. Or if it's a cardiologist, they're going to lean more towards the heart. The organization that I get most of my secondary training outside of, I do a lot all over the place, but the primary one is the Institute for Functional Medicine. If you've seen Mark Hyman, he's the chairman of the board. And the website for that is ifmmary.org. They also have a find a practitioner site that you can go look. What I will say is, because this is such a broad 30,000 foot view, even within that, there's some people that lean a particular direction or the other. So you want to ask a lot of questions if you're going to go to somebody and say, kind of, you know, what things do you do? Do you look at genetics and do you look at the organic acids? You want to do a little bit of research because, again, they might be coming from a world where they almost do completely hormones because that's 90% of the people that come to them. And so that's I'd say one of the big challenges is everybody has kind of their specialty. The other part I would say is, from my aspects, I see people from all over the world. So I have people in Africa, I have people in India, I have people in London, all over. Because the beauty of it is I help people with nutrition. I don't diagnose or treat, right? So I'm not telling you have something wrong with you, and I don't treat disease. And so from that, because all I'm doing is looking at what you should eat, what you should do with your body, and you know, if there is nutritional supplementation. So I don't have the limitations of a physician that needs to establish care and treat disease. So I see people from all over. So if you have a hard time seeing somebody, I can see you even from a distance. I do a lot of Skype. I do a lot of online, just because even if I have a lot of people, even if they're in town, they're like, I don't want to drive across town, which I get. You know, I'm like, to me, it's great. I can work both ways. So I do both. I have a nonprofit that teaches some of this stuff just because we need more people that can do this, right? I'm certified, so I have a secondary certification through IFM. It's a board certification that was designed really for physicians. They don't allow a lot of other people to take it. And they only have, I think right now, 1,100 practitioners worldwide that have passed that board. So it's not a lot. So it's, you know, unfortunate that we just don't have as much. It's growing rapidly because when I first started going to their trainings back in 06, you go to an event, it's like 400 people. Now it's 1,800, you know. So now it's exploding, but it's a lot of extra work on, you know, the practitioner side to go back. And it's like going back to school again, you know, for several years. But they are out there. So IFM is a good place to look.
All right. Well, it's 5:30. So I think that's the limit of our call. Betty, we could listen to you probably for another 2 hours.
Sorry.
At least I could.
Thank you.
Really good. Great.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
I hope you got at least some questions answered. I didn't confuse you more.
No, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Betty.
Very interesting.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
And yes, thank you all.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen.
Call. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very informative. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.